Coming Up Next Time podcast is brought to you in part by Built to Ride. Head over to builttoride.ca and pick up some coffee or apparel. Use the exclusive listener code COMEUP when you check out for an additional 20% off your order. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Barry Moore. I just want to take a second here and thank you all for sticking with me while I took a little summer break. Had a great time riding with the family, getting out to a race, and doing a lot of camping. Yeah, thank you for sticking with it. Okay, so my next guest is one of the team managers for ISDE Canada, the International 6 Days Enduro Team. He's a former ISDE competitor and medalist. Coming up next, this is Lee Freiberger.
Yeah, sure. I'm Lee Freiberger. I guess I'm, 52 years old. Live with my family. We ranch out, northeast of Brooks in a little place called Wardlow near Dinosaur Provincial Park. And I've been a motorcycle enthusiast probably since I was 7. Rode through my childhood and, and we are where we are today, I guess, which we'll go through through the interview.
So you work with the 6 Days team for Canada, do you not?
Yes. I'm one of the team coordinators with Renee Turner.
Nice. And you guys are planning a pretty big, endeavor for this year, pandemic racing, getting over to Italy for the ISDE 2021.
Yeah, it's a much smaller of endeavor than we've ever done before in some respects. The team's, however, call it average or maybe below average in size, but the format, our support program, is going to be significantly different. So the front end of the work that we've done is significantly greater because of the pandemic and unknowns that have been, we're all hoping that 21 would be the breakout year. Yeah. And then with the second wave globally, it just took that much longer to kind of see some clear air and kind of, plant our feet and make commitments. But it's been interesting, to say the least.
Well, I can only imagine. For the benefit of some of the listeners, because I don't know that everybody even understands what ISDE is, do you want to maybe highlight or describe the event?
Yeah, I'll do my best. So the International 6 Day Enduro, originally the ISDT, International 6 Day Trial, longest running motorsport event in the world. So it started in, 1913 in England, commonly known as the Olympics of motorcycling. So typically, you have a contingent from countries from around the world converging, just like the Olympics we're watching today in Japan, all representing our country at that venue. Originally just in the UK, and then, of course, they diversified to venues around the world, which is what it happens now is globally. The FIM, the Federation of International Motorcyclists, the global body that governs motorcycling, they choose a venue. And, of course, like the Olympics, you have venues that petition to them for hosting, and then, a number of years ahead of time, then they get awarded that privilege to host the world. So it travels around the world in different countries every year, never the same place, consecutively anyway. So it's broken down into four classes, let's call it. The World Trophy is four riders that are the elite from each country that represent that country. And they compete against the other World Trophy teams. The junior teams are the under 23, same thing. They're the elite of that age group. And then the ladies trophy, of course, self-explanatory. That's pretty new, in relative sense to the age of the event. So it's 2013, I want to say.
Okay.
Shelby, Lexi, and Victoria? Yeah, Victoria Head rode for ladies trophy in 2013. I believe that was the first year that they had that. And then, of course, it's hit and miss somewhat, but it is a great class because it develops those ladies, and there's lots of ladies, of course, trying to push to get into that category.
Okay.
And then the final is the what they call club. So clubs, and it's more of the amateur, what we in a sense may call amateur, but boy, there's some fast guys, former trophy guys, and it's highly competitive as well. And it's sort of frowned upon as in the, like I use the word amateur, but it's certainly not. Everybody there takes the same, they ride the same course, they ride the same time frame, time schedule, and they're equally as committed to doing as well. And the speed is 99% there. I don't know that a club person, club rider has ever overall the event, but the times are often very, very close.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be kind of frowned upon as in a, you know, still a privilege in my mind to be able to go ride the 6 days.
Yeah.
It's probably the only discipline of sport where you as an amateur, and, you know, we got to realize that there's very few people in Canada that ride the 6 days that are genuine pros, right? Like Tyler's. Probably the only guy currently, well, he is the only guy currently making a paycheck from racing. So the rest of us are all amateurs, and it's the only event or discipline of sport that we get as an amateur to go ride that elite 11 level of competition. So that's where I say the privilege. And it is a great event. It's an addiction. You can ask Jared, you can ask Tyler, Phil. Once you go see it and you experience it, it's an amazing experience of sport and camaraderie and, of course, you know, true competition.
Fair enough. Like, they all seem very dedicated to the training. Jared especially. Like, he's been sharing it on social media every step of the way.
And social media gives you gives you that spectrum where you have Jared who's that social media darling, and he converses with people really, really well. And then you get the guys who just grind and, you know, take Graham Jarvis where he just puts his basic hashtags and stuff. But, you know, there's work getting put in, and there's always the conversation in Moto about, you know, who looks like they're putting in the time and who, you know, is, but just don't put it out there. So
yeah,
you have to be committed. You know, by the rules, and typically we ride more than that, 250 kilometers per day, and it's on a schedule. There's no lunch breaks. There's no coffee breaks. They're on the bike for 7 hours a day for those first 5 days. The sixth day is the entire day is busy, but you're not on the bike all day. You know, have a short commute to route to the motocross track, and we re-impound, and then they run through the motos, through the different classes and stuff like that. So it is a 6 day event, and you need in my mind, the only event in the world that supersedes it as far as demanding mentally and physically is the Dakar. And it is you don't walk into that event unprepared, whether you think you are or not. Like, you know, people's fitness is very, very important, and then mentally you get challenged. You know, you have abrasions on your body, whether you're crashing or your boots don't fit well and your chest protector's rubbing. All these things kind of fatigue the body and the mind more so. And it really, the event kind of brings out those inner strengths in a person, and you can break down and rebuild. And I always call it character defining, because there's, you know, we always look at the magazines and we always say, you know, we want to be there, we want to do that. But you never know if you're truly ready until you get there and you've completed the event. And often when we're done, and I'm speaking from experience from racing it a number of times myself, it's like afterwards you're like, you know, not that sucked, but man, I'm done, like mentally, physically, you just hate it almost. And then a month later, when you kind of come out of that recovery phase, and it takes some time, especially when it's your first time and there's a lot of mental strain. When you come out of that hangover, call it a month later, and you're like, that was so incredible. And when you realize how low you were physically and how weak and beat up you were and how mentally you were tired, and you're a couple of times you might have thought, man, I don't know if I should continue. But you push through and you grab the bull by the horns and you take it to the end. And, you know, like I say, you know, oh geez, that sucked and that was hard. And then that month later, you're like, you're so happy and glad that you continued with it. And that's what's glorious about the event.
Yeah.
And the and I've had a DNF too, so I guess I can speak to that too, when you have an injury and then you second guess yourself for stepping out because of whatever happens. But still, there's a lot of preparation and determination takes a person to that point, and there's no shame in that either. Like, it's meant to be the Olympics, to prove people. And, anyways, I guess I could ramble on about
that's
the,
okay.
Fireworks of it.
With it being like the Olympics of motorsports or of enduro, and the Olympics being on right now, it's kind of a happy coincidence. I understand that they award medals like gold, silver, bronze. How do you achieve? Like, how do you get these medals? Is it like first place, second place, third place, or is it something else altogether different?
Yeah, way different scoring. So the riders ride with transponders. You're in that route, and it's on a schedule from control to control, or checkpoint to control, checkpoint to checkpoint. Within that route, there's the special test. So there's a segment of the course that's timed. So it's like a start gate. You start on their back end, and off you go. So every rider gets timed through these different special tests, and there's like, you know, usually 6 or 7 per day, and you end up with a 45 minutes to 50 minutes per day of special test time. So the person who is the leader at the end of the day, he has a certain score, and of course the leader will be the fastest one. He'll have the least amount of points on his score. You get 1 point per second.
Okay.
So that's an easy scoring system, right? And then they rank them overall in what they call the scratch. So that's the entire event from the first fastest guy to the slowest at whatever he might be, the 561st rider. Like, there's 500 to 600 riders in the event.
Yeah.
And then they also break you down into each category, and sort of it is simple in certain respects, this event, but then they break it out and it gets more complicated. But then you get the trophy class, then you get the different displacement classes within them. Anyways, directly okay. To the question. So each rider is got that score, and then you get the gold, silver, bronze. Gold medal is within 10% of the leader's score in your category.
Okay.
And again, that is back to the class. You get your gold medal. Silver is 25% of the leader in your class. And then the bronze is if you finish.
Okay.
And, and I guess it's perceived like, you know, as in the Olympics where you get third and you see, like, oh, that's a great accomplishment. Well, what the sixth day is, it is. You finish the sixth day, some guys, you know, kind of drop their chin, shrug their shoulders that, you know, they didn't get a gold medal. But I think we need to kind of realize that it's not easy to finish the sixth day.
No.
And if you get your ducks in a row, it seems that way, but at the end, it's not. So you get the trophy junior ladies, and then they all break that down into the gold, silver on that 10%, 25%.
I feel finishing the 6 days would be something special just in itself. Like, if you could imagine a different scenario, just a cross-country motorcycle adventure, very low demand on the body, riding the bike 7 hours a day, trying to get from coast to coast. A lot of people couldn't even do it. They couldn't do 7 days or even 6 days or 5 days straight on a motorcycle at 7 hours a day. So,
right. And then you put them on a timetable.
Yeah, that's right. You have to do it, like, by now, not leisure, like under.
Yeah.
And so
that's right.
I feel like,
yeah,
it's pretty sweet. Like, I mean, yeah, you have to finish. So it's not like, you know, when you got your DNF, they didn't award you a bronze medal, I don't imagine, because you didn't finish. Like, so yeah.
Yeah. And then the other aspect to it too, besides, you know, the gold, silver, bronze, but the timetable. So you're penalized if you're late to the control, 1 minute, your minute. If you're late 1 second, it doesn't matter. You're penalized 60 points or 60 seconds. But you're out of the event. You're excluded if you exceed 30 minutes of penalty points.
Okay.
So it's not like the Dakar where you can roll in whenever, however, as long as there's a bivouac there to feed you and to, you know, put some parts on your bike or whatever. If you're 30 minutes late to any control or the finish line, then you're excluded from the event as far as obtaining a medal, earning a medal.
Oh, wow.
So there's strains within the event to make sure that, back to the original aspect, it was called the trial, right? It was to push the mind and the body, or the mind, body, and the motorcycle. So you have to finish within that certain time period. And then the bike, when we impound, however many days, depending on the schedule, where Canada has to impound, but seeing photos where all the bikes get put in this impound or park for May, and we have to go through technical inspection. So the bikes get sound tested, because we're riding on public streets, so we can't be too loud. And the FIM dictates that sound test. It doesn't run on domestic rules as far as that's concerned.
Okay.
The bikes go through the technical inspection within domestic laws. What the local authorities require us to have as far as mirrors and signal lights.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, not signal lights. We don't run signals. But
head and tail.
Yeah, we have to have a headlight, tail light, brake light, but mirrors and speedos are always the kind of the questions about that. And currently it's pretty easy. There's all sorts of these rallies making a big push in the sport and adventure riding, and there's all these digital products we can buy with speedometers. So having speedos isn't such a big deal, but say 15, 20 years ago.
Could have been.
Before the electronic push. It was, yeah, and, you know, before these enduro-specific bikes were big, it was difficult to take a motocross bike and fit a reliable speedo onto it. And really, it was only a facade to satisfy the domestic authorities as far as that was concerned, but we still had to impound them with those functioning features. And then they get sound tested. The bikes get marked. Five components: the exhaust, the headlight, the wheels, and the frame and the engine cases, so that if you damage those parts, you're unable to change them. So back to the endurance and durability aspect of the event, the demand for that is, you know, you must preserve your motorcycle. You can't be thrashing wheels. You can't be, you know, crashing and bending frames and requiring those parts. You cannot change them. So you must keep the bike intact and preserve it. So there's back to the mental aspect of the event. You got to go fast. You got to send it, as they would say. But, you know, you can't send it that hard because there's only so many parts that you can change. And at the beginning of the day, you, of course, you're impounding with a fully complete operating motorcycle. At the beginning of every day, you get a 10-minute work period. But if you exceed the 10 minutes, you get penalized and back to your 30-minute hour out time. Recently was changed from 60 minutes hour out to 30 minutes because of the reliability of the bike. So we still call it hour out. So you get the 10-minute work period in the morning, and then you get a 15-minute service time at the end of the day. So cumulatively, you only have 25 minutes in the day officially to work on your bike. So back to the durability and preserving the bike, you can't spend all night fixing what you wrecked the day before. So your preparation of the bike has to be dead on. Your Loctiting, your safety wiring, and so forth has to be dead on. And then when you're riding, you can't be crashing. You can't be pushing it too hard that you're wearing out anything more than your basic parts, like, you know, brake pads, and, you know, your rivet link chain, so you're not worrying about clip links coming apart. And really, you know, in the last 20 years from when I took my first 6 day, you know, in those days, guys were still doubling up throttle cables, clutch cables, because of the durability. Those components maybe weren't that great, or were still suspect. We don't do that anymore because it's like the bike is, for the most part, is the given. They're so good, and it doesn't matter what color you ride.
Even if it's blue.
Is dependent. Even if it's blue, my friend. They are good.
Literally just trolling. I mean, one guy.
Yeah, no, and But, you know, there's maybe a specific model that may have an Achilles heel, but it's rare, right? And then guys kind of do stay away from that. But for the most part, bikes anymore, it's a way different day, right? You're running bib mooses, you don't worry about flat tires. The speeds are a little higher in a sense that because the bikes are, just like the discussion in motocross, is the bikes are that much better, so the speeds are higher. Bib mooses are an issue when you get into the high 30s as far as ambient temperature during the day. But, I mean, we don't worry about flat tires, and then we don't worry about wheels as much as long as they're maintained. You know, in the day, everybody used to carry chain breakers and rivet links and roller links and plate links just to make sure that, you know, if they had a failure on the trail that they could repair it. And the tool bag that they used to carry was significantly larger than it is today. Like,
oh, I can remember.
Folk wrenches or, right?
Yeah, it was like, even still, I have like old school things inside my tool bag on the trail, like chain links and stuff, like things that I don't know that I'm going to need to use. But like,
yeah
from back in the day, it's just like, even just crossing the country on a motorcycle, like you would have these things, spare spark plugs, all that kind of stuff, because bikes weren't reliable. Yeah. And then now, you know, dirt bikes have sort of come into a golden age where they are reliable, but I'm old enough to remember that they're not.
Yeah.
You know,
I think trail riding is a different aspect. I mean, we have different mechanical aptitudes and you ride older bikes and stuff like that. And that stuff can still be a challenge. You know, random things when we ride in the backcountry, you need to be prepared a little differently than say you would be at the 6 day. I
mean, yeah.
Buy a modern motorcycle. Yeah. With the 6 day, you're close to civilization. If you realize you forgot to gas up, and we always carry cash with it, so you can run to the local station along the route. If you trip on one in a village, and you can pour some gas in and off you go, there's no penalty unless you're late at the control. Right.
So
we're in the backcountry, it's way less forgiving. You know, we're wearing spots and things like that now. So I guess we're closer to technology and civilization with that. But we there's two reasons we never want to touch that. And one of those is shame and pride, right?
Yeah.
So we try and still be prepared.
You bet. But everybody does it. Yeah. I mean, you screw up. You go for a little ride, and then you don't think to refuel. And then you're the last one out of the camper. So you head off with everybody, and you find out you made a mistake.
Yeah. And then even at the 6 day, like this year, we're not running service within the team. We're renting service because the team's small. And part of the reason the team is what it is size wise with COVID is uncertainty. So we didn't know how many support people we were going to bring.
Okay.
And hence back to the service contract. Yeah. So we forget that, yes, this is world championship, you know, the elite and the Olympics, but we heavily rely on support and volunteers. So we kind of got to tone it down in the sense of expectations of who comes along. Normally, you know, you end up with 10 or 12 riders, depending on, how many teams you send. We can't send individuals. We're kind of able to with Tanner this year, which is great because he was very eager to go and had made, you know, crossed his T's, dotted his I's as far as quarantine commitments and all that sort of stuff is the trophy team what we're able to do also. But anyways, back to the teams, you know, and then a friend will come, mom and dad will come, a wife will come, a kid will come, and then we have enough people that we can, Renee, that's her responsibility, or one of them, I guess, is organizing that aspect of the support crews, where we send a team of support to each control, and then they're responsible for providing food, fueling the bike, having the selection of tools, which the team supplies, and providing that for the riders when they come in, and also supporting the rider with a timekeeping to support them with that, so that they don't have to really focus on the time. They can do what they need to do with for a seat. So when they get to a control, like again, we don't get a prescribed lunch break, and they don't get a prescribed 5 minutes of rest time. If they show up with 18 seconds before they're supposed to go through the control, that's a, as you might call it, dine and dash. They get into the control, they put gas in the bike, and I give them some food perhaps, and then the rider gets through the control. If they're fortunate enough, maybe they have some speed, they can arrive soon enough that they get more time, then they look at the bike and they can maintain it, adjust the chain, lube the chain, do all these other things, and back to the volunteers. And that become, there is a liability there when you have two strokes and mixing oil and different, you know, somebody forgets to put gas in, like we're humans after all, yeah. Right? And some things can, and it does happen, unfortunately. But we try and provide a system, I guess, for that support crew so that, you know, we have delegated tasks to each person. So there's no cross and you know, I did it last time, you do it next time. No. You know, we try and create a system that is trying to reduce the liabilities and reduce the chances of something going wrong, and then providing the best service for the rider so that they're confident and they don't have to worry about that aspect. They can just rely on, they can just focus on riding.
So the riders, they're responsible for their own like tire changes and air filters and all that kind of stuff, or does the support team do that?
Yeah, the rider is responsible for, name the number, 95% of the service. Mechanics can do things that are related to safety. So we can refuel the bike. We can check the coolant, add the coolant. We can bleed brakes. We cannot lube the chain because that's a maintenance aspect. And then once the parts are off the bike, the rider has to change the tire and has to do all the work. If the bike falls off the stand, no one can touch the bike. The rider has to put it back on the stand. The rider changes his own tire. But if you're changing an air filter, for example, you remove the air filter from the bike and put it on the ground. A support person can take the filter, remove the cage, put a new filter on that existing cage, put it back on the ground. And when the rider does his tire change, they remove the tire, they put the axle and the nuts adjusting blocks on the pad on our Enviromat, and then they go change their tire, and a support person comes along, cleans the threads, lubricates it, make sure it's all, you know, that's not going to cross threads, yep. It's not dirt in the threads and so forth, and so the reassembly goes as it should. We can't clean out the lugs in the swing arm, but the rider has to do that. But when we do the setup for the service at the end of the day, there's screwdrivers, T-handles at the front so you can loosen the clamps on the fork clamps, the axle clamps, I should say, and then screwdrivers to open the brake pads. We'll have a wire brush there so you can clean the dirt and mung and mud or whatever happens to be on them. And cleanliness is an issue. You have mud in behind the adjusting blocks on the rear axle, then you end up with, you know, they'll bed in and the axle will come loose. And so we do all the setup on that, have some lubes handy, and then the tire machines are all set up. So there's a big effort in the work area as well to make sure that goes smoothly.
I bet.
Everyone. Oh, and back to what the 60 is.
Yeah.
It has to be experience. Like I could rattle on for hours about not just my own experience, but the process and all this and different, the layers of all this that goes on.
Okay.
But when you see it, it's amazing. I feel privileged to be able to contribute. Like, you know, as a rider, you experience things and you think how, you know, you apply different things. And I worked in the motorcycle industry for a long time at dealerships and a little bit at the distributor level.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I kind of bring that experience forward and as a racer and for myself personally, you know, I find it a privilege. I don't feel that I deserve to be in this place. I strive every year to be as prepared as a rider, if that makes any sense. Like,
yeah.
Like I think I need to, right, to deliver and cover bases. And, you know, at the, you said it though, the rider is responsible at the end of the day for their timekeeping and their mechanical and all that sort of stuff. It all comes down to them, but I take a lot of pride in doing their due justice, providing what they need around them so that they can be the best that they can be.
Take a lot of the workload off of them so they can focus on their craft.
Yeah.
Oh, how does somebody get to be a team member for the ISDE for Canada?
There have been recruiting and maybe always have been, has happened in the past. I guess in the recent years we've done some because we've had, you know, we wanted to have a ladies team. We wanted to have a junior team and we're one person short. So we've reached out to people to fill that spot. But genuinely, and can't be stressed enough, is that if you want to come as support, if you're just an enthusiast, but you don't feel you have the skill, or you're just not a motor, you don't race, you just want to go enjoy the 60, or if you're a rider and you want to challenge it, reach out to the CMA or to myself or to Renee and sign up and go. It's not a recruiting thing because it's unjust to say some guy that lives in Kitimat, BC, that can be a rager, but nobody knows who he is, so he doesn't get the opportunity, even though he wants to go or she wants to go.
I get it.
You reach out. Yeah. We can't know everyone, right? So you reach out, and you know, it's hard, I guess, the way with the expanse of Canada, we don't have qualifiers. We don't have that, so we kind of got to go by word of mouth and discussions, and you know, use domestic race results to kind of sort it all out. You know, to put the teams together, and you know, if somebody doesn't make a team, how do you pick ABC person to fit in? But yeah, to answer your question, you have to basically reach out and say, "I want to go." Put your hand up and say, "I want to go." And I encourage anyone and everyone. Again, it is a 6 day, so you know, no junior riders, intermediates. In that class, it's kind of dependent on, you know, really your skills, because we don't want to lead somebody along unrealistically, given their skills and experience, to take them on this endeavor, because it's expensive.
Yeah.
And back, you kind of alluded to it with COVID, the commitments you take time wise, and then have them not, you know, make it through that day or something like that, and they're upset. We have to kind of be wary of that and mindful for people's time and commitment and money.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, well, I know there's people that live in a world of fantasy, but I feel like most people are pretty conscious of where they rank in their personal talent on a motorcycle. Like, unless you've never ridden with somebody else,
yeah.
You know, so if you're like,
yeah,
out training with the guys that make up the team right now, and they're lapping you, and they're having fun, and you're trying your hardest, that should give you a pretty good idea of where you're going to rank against the rest of the world.
Yeah, there's usually always a measure, but
yeah,
I'm pretty cognitive of that break even, call it, line of people, the club riders that want to go, and I have a tough time in that decision, because my first event, I was an alternate, and Julian Cerny had broke his wrist in 94 when we were going to Tulsa. And so I was going with a friend of mine, Bert Peterson, who was on the junior team at the time.
Yeah.
So I was going to spectate anyway, but I did try and qualify. So I was on the alternate list. And then 3 days before, whatever the number of days before we were supposed to depart, Julian's doctor report came back not good. And it's injured wrist didn't heal enough that he was able to compete on the trophy team, so they moved everybody up, and then I got asked to join. And you know, in talking to people around me, you know, they said, "Boy, you did good, but you know, we kind of didn't think you would." And not that I did well, I guess I didn't, but I finished, and I had all these troubles along the way, but I kind of didn't quit, which is the spirit of the 6 day.
Yeah.
So for me to select riders, I kind of, as you know, I want to give that person the time to grow. As I said, you know, the character defining, because sometimes you just don't know. Like, social media gives, you know, all these guys doing the senders and the Insta bangers and stuff like that. But how deep and how tough they really are, you don't know. Instagram doesn't show that. TikTok can't define that. It's once they've competed in an event like that, that's a measure then. So I personally like to give that person that opportunity, but
yeah. That's fair. It's the same way, I guess, race results don't tell how somebody was riding that day. Like you just look at the raw numbers, and you know, somebody has like a 30 minute lap to everybody else's 25. You think he was 5 minutes slower than everybody else. Meanwhile, his bike didn't start or whatever. right? Like, but you don't see that in the numbers. So.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, like we kind of got a different thing, I guess, if we are in that position of choosing riders, a number of different things to gauge it. So we just don't go off of results at times too. We do try and find out backstory because you're right. Like injuries, crashing, different things like that can be a factor for sure.
What could you expect to see like on your first 6 days? I mean, we've talked a lot about it, but we didn't really describe what it is. I mean, everybody's familiar with things like Sea to Sky and Erzberg and Romaniacs, but like, is the 6 days like that? Like when you arrive, there's thousands of people or tens of thousands of people, or is it because it's just spread out over a wide area? It's harder to tell.
6 days, depending on the venue, and the country you go to, France, I can think of, the final moto, 15,000-20,000 people.
Holy.
And along the route, like it's again, back to seeing the event to really understand it. You go to, like this year in Italy will be incredible for people.
I can imagine.
Route wise for the riders. Yeah, and then for the spectators, we're going to feel like, or they will feel like rock stars because they'll be old men in their little beret hats out there leaning on their cane watching motorcycles go by and kids giving, you know, the wheelie gesture to get guys to wheelie. And there's, I think it, like, Erzberg is its own thing. Like, you see the photos of it and then to be there is, it's its own animal. And it is, you know, this little town of 3,000 people that take Blairmore and add 50,000 people into it and it turns into the beer tent and then this big, you know, it is what it is, but 6 days is almost 6 days of that.
Oh.
Depending on the country and the population density around it. And then for us, you know, it's a 2-week endeavor for us. So we arrive that week before to riders all walk special paths and then there's logistics that we are planning and things like that. But the paddock itself, when you take 30, 35 countries and you take 500-600 riders, you're talking 3,000 to 5,000 people in a parking lot like South Center Shopping Mall. It's its own little, like the bivouac at the Dakar when you look at photos of that. And really go to Enduro 21 or any of these other media guys that cover the 6 day, like the paddock itself is this little micro city of people and not vendors, depending on the country. Italy would be incredible that way because it's so embedded with racing, you know, all these different Alpine Star, you name the company that's based there, Garnier, CD, you know, Beta, the motorcycle brands itself that come out of that country. So there'll be vendors like Matt and the number of people there, whether they're moms, dads, team guys, you know, you'll see, you know, which was the amazing part for me that I learned once I got into more of the management coordination role of the team is who was in my role on different teams. They were all former 6 days guy. Like I remember going to the administration building one day and there's a older fella from Holland in front of me and it was Garrett Wolfsink and you know, I Google his name about, and he was involved in the management of the Dutch Federation, right? And you look at the Italian Federation and their managers are all world champions, right?
Like yeah.
The depth and the knowledge and the experience and my experience with Husaberg, you know, Thomas Gustafsson, I think he stopped going to the 6 day in 2015, I think, when we were in Slovakia. It was maybe the last time he was involved in the team. But, you know, how many world championships did he win? You know, national championships, and then when he started Husaberg, how many world championships between motocross and Earl did his team win? And so that depth of experience is incredible on the upside of that. And I guess that's something I would like to see our team build on in the future. Like, you know, Blair Sharpless is involved in the Gold Fund and providing some financial support for the team, you know, and he's been to 13, 6 days, and I can't remember his gold medal count, but the guy, you know, he's won national enduros in the States, and he's a guy that we were revered by, you know, of his day, you know, the Steve Hatches, Rodney Smith in the States. So, like, we need to get him, you know, everybody's got their time in life.
Yep.
I'm hoping with his, you know, time in life, he's, you know, able to join the team and help build our foundation on the support side. You see guys like Shane and his boys and, you know, what Shane, you know, look at the Cuthbertson family, you look at Giroux and in Quebec and his, you know, young boy riding, and you just wonder that these families, like they do in these other countries, will kind of foster into the 6 day and end up with mentors of old racers for these young fellows.
That's fair. Like when you touched on our team, could we just talk about Team Canada? Like how we the members are right now, and I guess historically, how do we do? Like are we a gold medal team? Are we like participation medal level? Like, where do we rank in the world?
So your previous question is about gold.
Yeah.
And I think we'll just kind of back there quick, and because it relates to this, right? So yeah. You get a guy like Tanner. He's an enthusiast. The first goal is to finish.
Yeah.
And you take Jared and Phil and Tyler, who, you know, each been there 2 to 3 times each. Then they know the process. They know everything they need to know about the 60, except the venue, what the train will be like. And that's, you know, maybe where the guesswork, but again, my mantra is be prepared for what you're not prepared for. So you just go there as prepped as you can, open-minded, and away you go. They start sitting down. Okay, what do I want to do? Yes, they're gold medal guys. They want to ride World Trophy because they want to challenge themselves against the best in the country, which is, as a competitor, that's, you know, always challenging yourself against somebody that's better than you.
Yeah.
And then they try and whatever, set up their goals, like team-wise and personally. Like, obviously, gold is, you know, they're disappointed if they don't achieve that.
For
what's
sure.
the team going to do? I don't know if they've sat down and tried to do some math and figure out where they're going to go. I've done it in past years where, you know, we always used to say the team would be in the top 5 if we could send our best riders. And I've done the math on that one and a couple times when we had the Nationals. We had the Canadian Enduro Championships in 2009 to 2012. You know, a guy like Woljo, Brian Wojnarowski from Ontario, he was traveling east to west and also going to the 60 at the time, and he was number 2 in the country after that series. And, you know, did the math, and you know what? We might get top 10 if we took all of Woljo at that particular event. If you put 5, at the time, the trophy team was 6 teams, 6 riders, and we scored 5 of them. And, you know, I think today, though, we're in a different realm with Tyler's moto speed, his outright speed, Jared's experience, and his, you know, he didn't get to the level that Tyler did as far as national motocross, but he had his shining moments and he's got potential for speed, which is something we haven't taken for a long time. And the 6 days has changed from, you know, I believe in the old days, I would liken the 6 day to what they have now with the extreme enduro kind of concept. Like it was an extreme and very much challenging as far as completing the event and the course and stuff. Today it's more about outright speed. Phil's the off-road guy that can ride roots and rocks and that really technical stuff as well as anybody. And I don't mean extreme enduro technical, but like going fast through slop and GNCC style stuff.
Yeah.
He's got very good speed there, but he's been working on his motocross speed and he's been elevating, and watching him in Portugal in the final moto, like he wasn't that far behind Tyler. So he's elevated, and I'm excited about him reaching new levels as far as his own personal speed. And then Cade Walker, who's been, I think he told me he's been in Italy for 10 years. So we don't really know who he is unless we've been recently introduced to him and watching him on social media. So he's on the KTM Italian importer, Ferrioli. He's a former world champion and he imports KTM into Italy. So he's on a support team and he's doing Italian championships, national championships, and also the world championships. So he just finished Sweden this last weekend and did, I think he placed 5th in E1 both days. So he's kind of finding himself proving himself. And he's not an enduro rider, from what I gather of his experience. He's a motocrosser.
Okay.
Rode on support teams over there in the past few years. So he's quite quick on the motocross track. And then now he's feeling his way through this off-road stuff and kind of finding his groove. And so hopefully, if all goes well on the support side, we're renting Tanner, I think, is riding on a Jolly, which is an independent team, an enduro team. And then the other guys are KTM support service. So the service should be bulletproof.
Yeah.
As long as they can keep their bikes together and don't crash, then we should be.
As long as the seventh. Oh, sweet. That's pretty respectable.
That's my gut about where we're going to go. These guys are fast. Like the Euros, like, you take a number of these fellows, like, I'm trying to think of, Antoine Mayo, who, I think won the E2, and battled with Tyler in Portugal. And I know Tyler made this comment there. He's like, who's this Antoine fellow from France? And okay, that guy, he's a, you know, rally guy. I can't remember if he's overall to Dakar or not, but he was a, I don't know, number time world enduro champion, but he was also a motocrosser prior to that. And I know the big news a couple of years ago was he showed up at the Paris Supercross with his rally bike and rolled the whole track and jumped it with his rally bike.
Oh, wow.
And where does this off-road guy get that speed? Like the Americans are starting to do, like those guys all cross-train in moto. And in Europe, they don't have the access to public lands like we do. And as I know, our world is shrinking there, but we're still very fortunate for what access we do, because there's countries that just don't have access to that vast amount of land.
Yeah.
And we should value what we have and work hard to keep it. But so these guys are all cross training, and lots of former motor guys over there, whether they get an injury that they can't push that hard and for the jumps and so forth, and then they make a transition into off-road, or like Tyler at the kind of the dusk of their moto career, but they still have that fire as far as competition with Brian Sipes and name the guy who just makes that transition from moto to off-road. And so these Euro teams are really fast. The outright speed is sick, and then they'll just, you know, it's easy in Instagram to talk about sending it, but those guys genuinely have a switch that they turn click when they get on the bike that, you know, mortality means very little to them. It's all about winning, and it genuinely is. And they're not satanic. They're not sadistic. They just have a switch, and they like pushing as hard as humanly possible. And we're pretty guarded that way for the most part, until you take a guy like Tyler, who's methodical. And he's not crazy. Like, you watch him go on his intensity, but he's methodical and he's smart. 6 days is not about a guy who can go unbelievably fast and not think about what he's doing, because those guys end up, you know, on the stretcher.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, the send it is not something. Like... No, that I can understand. Yeah, if you're not focused, you're in trouble. And the throttle is whatever it is, but like, you need to have a balance, because you got to think big picture, not just in the minute. So
absolutely, yeah.
No, that's crazy. So last year is the first year since World Wars that the ISDE has been canceled. Like,
right.
That's gonna. I imagine that's going to have like some kind of like jubilation, you know, there'll be like extra celebration because they get to do it. I don't know. I'd like to hope anyway.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We're excited to go. Like, we're, Renee and I are the team coordinators, but we're also the delegates that represent Canada to the FIM. So we have accreditation, and, at the end of the day, I guess another level of the layer in the onion is at the end of the day of the competition, every day, Renee and I would go to these meetings where every country sends a representative, and we go through the day and break it all down. And if there's any problems, we sort out and complaints or protests or whatever. Right. But we're on a WhatsApp thread with all the delegates with that group within the 6 day. And, you know, the communication that's coming through that, you know, we communicate changes and updates and things like that on there, but there's personal stuff too, to a degree where, you know, you get that clip from that person, that comment where like, we're really excited to come back after COVID and, you know, after missing last year and, you know, everybody, at the end of the day, are just like us, right? We want to go, you know, visit and see sport and see the racing and the competitiveness and see what our guys can do and our ladies can do and our team can do, and go live a little bit, you know, given the, you know, debate what you will about COVID, but I mean, there's still like the logistics of getting there, today is quite something. COVID tests between different connection airports and protocols. We've got an exemption from the Italian Olympic Committee for the 6 days to enter without quarantine. So we have to go through all the testing procedures that any traveler would go through. But then once we arrive, we have that exemption. So anyways, it makes that aspect a little simpler. Now, that was a big part of what was so unknown, like, you know, our deadline for the 6 day originally, when we send our initial deposit to the FIM at the end of March is, you know, we have to find out who wants to ride it. And then we have to kind of formulate that plan about, you know, who can ride, how many teams does that make up, and then, you know, move forward with that sort of structure and then make the commitment to the FIM. But at that time, when we were kind of trying to set our deadline for everybody to have their entry application in, was we couldn't even buy a flight to Italy. So how would, you know, Tanner, for example, sit down with his mom and dad, and he wants to go really badly, and he's like, I don't care. And his mom and dad, you know, like anybody who wants to travel with them, you know, logically, is how can you go? You can't buy a ticket. And as a manager, I'm sitting there on the other side going, I can't, invite these people in. And there's all these liabilities. And, you know, and I've been on that as a rider when, you know, there's problems. And then, you know, you want to reduce the number of opportunities for people to point fingers. And as a rider, you see how much money they're putting in. Like, it's a, use the number $15,000 to, normally when we do support, the rider comes, but they have to bring somebody with them to make up that support team. I've been there when we didn't have that on the team. And, I go to the 6 day and, you know, there's these passionate people that are involved. Mike Kelly, Jan and Betty Van Dyke, Dave Armstrong, Hazel Armstrong, Butch, that, you know, call it sold their soul. They would work tirelessly, and we could be critical of very, you know, this and that of them, but in reflecting back, like, they did so much to make sure that we had the best experience, make sure we had gas, that the tools were there. It was like incredible, the amount of effort. And I see that and I want to replicate that, but we did mandate that the riders bring people so that we didn't have a lack of support, so that all that effort, you go there and then there's nobody to pour gas. So, the logistically to bring this forward in that old format was really difficult. And the riders, of course, their own, you know, like as a sportsman, I guess as the old phrase would be, you know, you want to go compete, but, you know, you have this normal life, you have work, you have your family, maybe you're 20 and you don't have a family yet, but your mom and dad, your sisters, and then you get your friend circle or whatever, right? You have this normal life, this 100% the circle, this pie of your life. And then you want to interject 6 days in it, and it becomes all encompassing. There's a financial demand. There's a demand on the sense of riding and training. There's a demand on diet. There's a demand on sleep. And then you have to force all that stuff into smaller pies. And that's where the challenge with COVID came, was people were, you know, that second layer of support, families, brothers, sisters, all those support people also had demands. And not, you know, like you mentioned, Kristen and the commitment to time. You know, they were also then having to commit to that. And 6 days is a challenge with that $15,000. And then you were to extend the quarantine on either side. And personally, I was not asking riders to do that.
Yeah,
pardon me to do that. It doesn't make any sense. It's great, but it's not that great to do. And it'll be around next year. So and as it turned out, right? Like we had a junior team, we had a ladies team, and we had, I think, a club team. Yeah, for sure. We had at least one club team. It seems like a long time ago. COVID seems to erase memory a little bit, but then when it really came down to crunch time, the FIM did on our plea, like anybody that was off the EU continent, we were pleading with them, like, we can't make commitments now because it just, we can't make commitments, right?
Yeah.
There's too many unknowns. And then they pushed it off to the middle of May, and then it was starting to soften up at that point in time, but it wasn't enough yet. But on their end, they needed to know, like, there's so many layers in the onion with this. So then, you know, that's where the ladies team went away and the junior team went away, and the club guys were like, you know, they want to bring their family with them and they want to share this experience.
Have fun. Yeah.
Yeah. As much of a grind as it is for the rider, like my wife has been with me most times I went to the 6 day as a rider and most times that I've been as a coordinator. And she's had way more fun than I ever had. I mean, yes, as a rider, I have those levels of accomplishment, but the people we know around the world and she's met and the relationship she's built is, and lots of people have that experience, right? You know, you're out of control and you're intensely focused for that however period of time when the riders come through and you're handing out goggles and baby powder and gloves and your guy needs a wrench for his axle and a chain adjusting tools and needs a rag to clean his goggles and, you know, they're, you know, tying up the girl's hair because their ponytail's hanging out, and by the rules you can't have that because it's danger of getting caught up in the motorcycle. There's all these different things, and then they all leave, and then you walk down the street to the local little cafe and you enjoy some, you know, there's little bistro. Yeah, like there's all these little cultural things that the support people get to enjoy.
Yeah,
and it just it's too tight. It was too many unknowns, and it just, you know, we sat down and we had a Zoom meeting, and I got to give it up to those people that brought that to the meeting. And, you know, our trophy team were committed, and that's easy, right? In their realm, yeah. They knew, like, for Phil, he's an agriculture like I am, so I can quarantine on my place and not see anybody, and it happens on a regular occasion to me anyways, but Tyler's the same way, right? Phil or Jared can make that commitment. But the biggest thing for me that I got to give credit to the riders that came to that meeting and told us the honest truth is that they couldn't manage it. And it was tough. Like, they were honest, and nobody wants to quit. The 6 days isn't about quitting. Obviously, there's
no, they're not quitters.
Things like that when it's
done. Yeah.
Right. And it's not about quitting. But they brought it to that meeting and say, you know, we can't, we won't. And,
yeah.
And I applauded them then and tried to applaud them afterwards, and I still do because it's tough. Nobody, you know, COVID's been tough on people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether directly or indirectly. And in sports, it's not easy. So
that's fair. Do you know if there's any plans for Canada to be a host nation?
Oh, there's a few campfire discussions. Yep.
Nice. Because I going through the whole thing, it's mostly Europe, and it's very rarely has it come to America, like to North America, period. So it'd be kind of sweet if it did.
Yeah, I think we'll see what happens. I mean, it's pie in the sky dreams. There's a couple people that really want to make it happen. There's a lot to it. I know it's easy to talk about the U.S. efforts because of public land there, which they don't have, and then with their judicial system and liabilities, like they've had many efforts of different clubs and regions wanting to put the 6 day on in the States, and they always have a tough time with insurance.
Yeah.
I know when the last time it was in the States was in Tulsa, and it was on the John Zink Ranch. So from what I gather, the story is, you know, wealthy man had a lot of land and they rented it or whatever, however they got permission to enter the property, and they staged it completely from that operation and within his perimeter of the property, but his insurance lawyers wouldn't let the public in. So we were, as an event, we were missing that. Where Europe, they have a way different philosophy on liability and litigation and sport in general, right? Like when you take, you know, you look at any motorsport in Europe, and it's crazy. And like I referenced France in 2001, the final moto, yeah, it was like looking at motocross the nations, and it, yeah, it's pretty special. For us to do here, yeah, we need to find a space that you can put on, you know, you have 1,200 kilometers of trail, a medical system that can support, you know, an international airport relatively close, so you don't have a 10-hour drive through the Muskeg to get to, you know, there's all these different parameters that you kind of got to meet, and they have a certain level of that you have to meet and criteria, the FIM demands for you to have in your location.
Yeah. So
it'd be great as a country to hold it here. It takes a massive workforce as well to do it because of the managing the ribbons on special tests. You know, those are 5 or 8 kilometers long, and there's say 6 or 7 of them in a day.
Yeah.
Then your control people that manage the timekeeping, and you got redundancies with ensuring that timekeeping is executed properly. The paddock security, you're just all these different people. There's so many people that are needed. There's probably an army of people equally as large as the ridership, at least, to put the event on. So yeah, maybe, fingers crossed, truly it would be great
because
there's some great terrain here.
Oh my God. Yeah. There's spots. There's definitely areas to showcase, make the race go from BC to like Saskatchewan or something.
Yeah, get a variety of ground.
Yeah.
There's something that we have to be careful of. I know organizing some different events myself that you have to be cognizant of, you know, lots of these events, you ride 2 days in a row on the same course. So you have 600 riders and you make a 250K loop. That's a lot of erosion potentially, yeah. Right? Like that's why we run the DOT tires, because, you know, the environmental impact, and we all know what people perceive in Canada of dirt bikes, like or
it's not
hedonistic
good.
And all that sort of thing. And yeah, it's really the community is not like that. But I guess, however, the perception is what it is. So we have to satisfy that aspect also. And it'd be foolish to, honestly, there's many areas that we ride in the eastern slopes that it'd be great to ride to bring the world to this place, but you couldn't because it's the elevation is too severe and it would be erosion in the. We wouldn't have a trail system after when we were done. So we have to go to some parts of Saskatchewan probably would be the best because it wouldn't erode if that the elevation is where I live actually in the flats here, it would be also okay to a degree.
There's also something like I'd hate to have the 88 Olympic effect and showcase something and then forever never get to ride it myself because the whole world comes on their moto vacations.
Yeah.
You know, Banff is fine in Banff, but imagine Banff like out in the eastern slopes or like Banff of Moto. That would suck.
Yeah.
I almost don't even want to say any places. Yeah. I don't want to curse anybody. Jinx.
Yeah, but we'll bring the world to Alberta in a couple different venues in the 6 day in, and we'll try and get the 6 day in some other places perhaps. Yeah.
There you go. Sweet. Well, we're at about an hour now, Lee. So, I just want to thank you for your time. I guess, is there anything or anybody you want to give a shout out to?
Yeah, I guess I mentioned their names earlier. I guess on a personal note, Butch Kelly, Jim started the team in the early 70s and continued. I think Butch came to Italy with us in 2013 when I was there with Shane and Jared. And, you know, the amount of time and effort that they put in as volunteers to build the team. And Dave Armstrong followed Dave and Hazel in that role of team manager. And Jim's son, Mike, was instrumental. Like, you know, he's been in various different levels of coordination. Betty and Jan van Dyke, they've been involved in the team since, I think, 84, maybe the 6 day was in Holland and their family lived across the street from where the Canadians were, if I'm not mistaken on the story. And they've been involved in the team at some level since then, like Holland and in Canada have had a relationship, you know, a very kind relationship.
Nice.
Post World War II and fondness. Right. And they're dear people to the team and also all of those people, great people individually. Right. So, to me, that's the backside of the team on my position. And then Blair Sharpless as that competitor, and he managed the team for a couple of years in the early 90s. And then, you know, he's had a family and a career, and I hope to see him. But he's been instrumental in the Gold Fund fundraising, and that funds go to support the team once we arrive, and picking up the odds and sods expenses for the riders so they don't have to pull out their credit card as often while we're at the event for all the seemingly trivial little things, but very important things. And then I guess personally too, I guess my wife, Carrie, she's followed me through these endeavors and supported me through all this too. And like I said, she's had a lot of fun, but she's let me spend money and a lot of time. And off we go. Yeah.
Sweet. All right, buddy. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to wrap this up right here. And well, that brings us to the end of another episode. I want to thank my guests for taking the time to sit down and chat with me. A special thank you to you, my supporters. Without you, this would not be possible. If you enjoyed the show, give it a 5-star rating. And if you haven't already, be sure to like, subscribe, and share. If this is your first time listening, I encourage you to take the 3-episode challenge. Once again, thank you for your continued support, and stay tuned to find out what's coming up next time.